From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we have our weekly conversation with Professor Tony Montero via Skype from Philadelphia with an update on Russiagate, the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings, the midterm elections coming up, and a lot more. Okay, Tony, so, wow, let's see, Russiagate, Kavanaugh, S-300s, spies, who knows what else. Let's start, I guess, with Russiagate.
Yeah, because, you know, that is where it begins, and that's where it's still at, and that is what all of this is about, that the deep state and the neoliberals, who call themselves liberals, had expected a Hillary Clinton victory and a hard push on Russia with the Ukraine, Eastern Ukraine, with the Baltic states, and especially Hillary Clinton had said, were she elected, she would establish a no-fly zone over Syria.
Yeah.
With the election of Trump, all of that has fallen apart. Not to mention the other side of this, the withdrawal of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, his renegotiation of NAFTA, and his pullback, at least gesturing towards that, of a pullback from an all-out support for NATO and for the U.S. Military war games and the U.S. Military presence on the ground and around the seas of the Korean Peninsula. So at that level, which I think is the fundamental level, everything orbits. Trump is unacceptable because he has violated and transgressed what is the neoliberal, neocon, unipolar, dollar-denominated world that they were pushing to maintain. So that's what it's all about. And even Kavanaugh cannot be understood, the hearings and so on, cannot be understood outside of this global imperialist framework and, of course, the 2018 elections fit into that.
Wow. You know, I mean, they managed to make, you know, this attack on Russia to continue it, really, through the loss of the 2016 election. You know, when we saw it, it's been, you know, shaping up almost since 1993, really. Clinton, the war on Yugoslavia, the interference in the presidential election in Russia in 1996. Certainly ever since Putin took office, and particularly when they started to push back on the invasion by Georgia of southern Russia and the interference in Ukraine in 2014. There was, you know, war games going on, you know, upping of military resources in Europe and Asia focused at Russia, and increasingly also China with the South China Sea. In other words, all of these things necessary to fully implement this policy were being, you know, put in place bit by bit. And then Trump gets elected, and part of the program is to, you know, back off of some of that. And yet with this Russiagate narrative, you know, we saw even a vote in the Congress of 400 and something to, you know, 5 or 10 to add sanctions to Russia after Trump became president. It's the deep state seems to still be in power with respect to this particular issue.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And this is one of the great contradictions of this moment, and which makes it quite unique. You have a president who, on these matters, literally stands alone. They took down Flynn, General Flynn. They have convicted Manafort, and what convicted him, I think, which swayed the jury, was this whole idea that he was doing business on behalf of Putin in the Ukraine, right, when it was completely the opposite.
Right.
He was working for the then Ukrainian government, but on behalf of moving them closer to Western Europe rather than to Russia.
Right.
Trump pretty much is besieged in the White House. I think at this point he is campaigning to hold on, that the Republicans hold on to the House of Representatives as a hedge against his being impeached. I therefore take umbrage with those people, sadly, who continue to label him a fascist. Does he play to the extent white racist views of a large part of his base? He does. But that is not the totality of the question, because he's also playing into the class interest of a good part of the industrial workforce, as witnessed by the fact that the leaders of the industrial unions, the UAW, United Steel Workers, the United Electrical Workers, and the AFL-CIO as a whole, have met with him on several occasions on matters having to do with NAFTA and other trade agreements. We should also keep in mind that he is talking about renegotiating the trade deals with Europe, with the European Union. So he is a, as we say, a transgressive, almost subversive figure in American presidential politics. There's never been anything quite like him, and there's never been anything quite like the move of the dominant sections of the ruling elite to bring him down.
Yeah, this is certainly a lot of uncharted territory. It's almost impossible to avoid, depending on what keywords you type into Google, for example, things. If you type in removing P-R-E-S, one of the top hits is removing president from office. And you get, like, the top one I found is Reuters. Today, from August of 2017, that details impeachment and the 25th Amendment, how to remove the president from office. So you get, looking at this, a majority of the House of Representatives would allow impeachment, but impeachment, of course, is not removal from office. Impeachment, rather, is removal of the immunity from prosecution, and that in turn enables the removal from office, which requires a 2/3 vote in the U.S. Senate. That's a stretch at the moment, looking at the polls.
I think it is, yeah. but of course it is a political strategy.
Yeah,
I would say it, albeit a desperate one on the part of the Democrats, to make a move for 2020. To literally enable him. They thought this Kavanaugh circus would do it.
Yeah.
But it is. I think it's backfired on them.
Yeah.
Because rather than animating and exciting what they consider to be the natural female base for Democrats, rather than doing that, it's doing the opposite.
Right.
And it's exciting Trump's base.
Right.
So even if they move, you know, on impeachment, as you point out, what that is, as a political maneuver, it still might not work. And here's why I don't think it will work. I think the anti-establishment sentiments among a decisive part of the American electorate is so deep that it, and he is their representative, it's so deep that it's difficult to imagine it disintegrating in the face of an all-out attack by the corporate media upon Trump, directly or indirectly. I mean, yeah. And this is a political moment, the likes of which none of us have seen.
Yep.
Ever.
I mean,
maybe ever in the history of the country.
We're seeing evidence of that repeatedly every time that there's a massive, you know, one of these massive attacks on Trump. They get surprised that at the end of it, his polling goes up.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
There's another example of that today with this Kavanaugh thing. And particularly, and this is very important going into an off-year election, in terms of hardening the resolve of people to vote to protect and or take out the their respective favored party. You got also the phenomenon, as this phenomenon goes on, of the loss of legitimacy in the institutions, the anger and willingness to look outside of the almost robotic responses that people were conditioned to politically for decades, looking at an outsider champion. In the absence of Trump, if they're successful, I mean that mood is there. So they have to offer someone else. Well, Sanders, also benefited from that back in 2016. I don't think he's going to be that champion again. I think he's exhausted it. They whip out Warren. She's a tamer version. You've got Harris, and I don't credibly see anybody buying into Booker for that, but whatever. Whoever they wheel out, though, to substitute for this, for the same reason that it didn't go away with the taking out of Sanders, the conditions facing people are either going to improve under Trump, which is going to harden his personal support, or continue to deteriorate, which is only going to intensify this feeling of anger and alienation. And so if they put a faker in there, one of their own wholly owned corporate subsidiary fakers in there, 10 minutes later, when they fail to deliver and they start talking about why we need more austerity and war, you're going to see a response again from the population, and it's going to be angrier and more hardened and more skeptical and more willing to get radical than they were by electing Trump.
See, and I think one of the great ironies of this moment is that it is possible, not in the 2018 election, but in 2020, Trump could increase his black support substantially. And there are polls that show that Trump is improved very, very much among black voters, his support among black voters. The other thing in 2018, although the districts that they have to flip are pretty much all white districts or majority white districts, those districts also could be decided by a small black and Latino vote.
Right.
And I would suggest that black folk, whom I know best, have no incentive to vote in 2018 in any significant numbers. I don't think the anti-Trump position of the Democrats and their hiding behind the Me Too movement is enough to encourage black voters to vote. In other words, black voters will vote by not voting. And I think in 2020, Trump looks very strong generally, but I think from the 5% that he got in 2016, it could go up to 10 or 15% very easily. And I think the key thing will be the industrial Midwest,
right,
and his renegotiating NAFTA, his talking about bringing the repatriation of capital back to the United States, and his whole thing with China and the so-called trade war is really about General Electric, General Motors, Apple, the big chemical corporations and other U.S. corporations that have gone to China under the rules of the WTO as a way of seeking out the cheapest sources of labor. And what Trump is saying is that at least he hears the voice of the workers, of the farmers, of the others who are not a part of the financial oligarchy. And this resonates. This resonates very deeply.
You know, an interesting piece on the front page of Washington Post today. As Trump's tariffs boost the steel industry, workers wonder where their windfall is. In other words, clearly the Washington Post is an enemy of Trump. Bezos personally, has it in for Trump. He's trying to take him out. He has been from the get-go. I don't think anyone debates that. So what we're seeing, though, is the same Washington Post that said that this program, that treaty, this tax bill is not going to boost the steel industry. In fact, it has. And so now it's a matter of repositioning it and saying, okay, well, who gets to own this? And so they're farming the area of, were enough people hired yet? Or is there enough of an increase in wages, et cetera, having to acknowledge already that, well, he did what he promised and it worked like he said. It's just a matter of, has it reached the people that voted for him yet?
See, and I think going forward, we're going to see something quite interesting, especially as the labor movement moves towards him on trade and away from the Democrats. This will provide for Trump what should have materialized after he won in 2016 and the campaign upon which he ran, a left wing that is saying the opposite of what his right-wing supporters are saying. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That directs him more towards the working class, towards the black community, towards Latino communities, and not be enslaved for political expediency to the likes of Fox News and Hannity and those people. Right now, there's not a significant left that is saying to Trump, we agree with you here, we agree with you on Korea, we agree with you on Russia, we agree with your non-interventionist position. We know that there's a right wing pulling you in the opposite direction, but you should know there is a politically active left wing and labor base that you will need going forward. And I'm certain that he is open to listening to that side. But at this point, that is not the vocal side. If he is to survive in the short run, sadly, he has to succumb to the support that he's getting from the right-wing Republicans. But he is not, he is above, he transcends. And this is the key thing. His politics transcend the normal politics of the two parties, Democrat or Republican. He just has not yet had the opportunity, I believe, to fully expand the base of his potential support.
You know, it's an interesting dance that we've seen since the late July, early August, when Trumka from the AFL-CIO had that little sit-down, and he was literally praising Trump over his position on trade and the implications of that for workers in the United States. And then by September 2nd, which is the beginning of the election season, basically, he turns around and hits Trump hard over a lack of support for the working class. And so you've got that phenomenon going on, but you also have the stuff that's going on. Normally, the leadership, quote unquote, of labor unions, I think more specifically, completely in the tank for the Democrats. You have some exceptions like Reagan, et cetera. Their, you know, their dedication to imperialism is even greater than the dedication to the Democratic Party, and I think that that was the breaking point with Reagan and to racism too, where it, you know, where it factors. But you've had now a situation where the working class, first of all, the union membership is down to, you know, a fraction of what it was 30, 40 years ago. It's been a steady, I would say erosion doesn't, it's an erosion like the kind that you get, you know, and after a hurricane. The erosion has been a steady thing since at least the PATCO strike during Reagan, and so their own personal influence is, you know, as leaders of unions, you know, has weakened substantially, and also the institutional power of unions has weakened substantially. But they, the leaders still have to follow somewhat the sentiment among the workers, and the workers are among the most disillusioned for some of the reasons I just detailed of all people in the United States. And they... a good part of them, at least the ones that we saw in Ohio, for example, and the phenomenon that we saw in Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, et cetera, Pennsylvania, they were willing to try Trump out, and he has done the things he promised, from the NAFTA and TPP and all of that, and, like we just mentioned with Steele, there's starting to be a response. With all of that, at some point between now and, say, 2020, certainly, if Trump actually delivers economically, does the gravity of that even pull the leadership of the labor unions in the U.S., you know, by compulsion, basically?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think they're already there. I don't know what Trump has said. I know that he has met at the White House, along with other leaders of unions, with Trump at least twice over questions of trade, hardly reported. There's no interviewing of labor leaders after the renegotiation of NAFTA. They weren't at all. No one asked what the labor unions thought of this. It is though the corporate media is not only trying but has succeeded in keeping the voice of labor out of the discussion, even of economic issues that are vital to working people, mm-hmm. which says to me that somebody somewhere understands that there's a political shift, even at the level of the leadership of the industrial unions. I'm focusing upon them because that is what this, all of these trade deals are related to, that among industrial unions, I don't know what Trumpka said, but I do know he said that the AFL-CIO supported Trump in the renegotiated NAFTA when it was only with Mexico. I know he said that. And I'm certain when it comes to the Canadian deal, he has said nothing less than that. But you're right. At the level of the rank and file of labor, be it miners, be it steel workers, be it electrical workers, be it auto workers, at that level, there is a perceptible shift away from the Democrats towards Trump. And I would say that you cannot pigeonhole Trump as a Republican. He is not a Republican president in the traditional sense of a Nixon or Reagan or a Bush or even the leaders of the Republican Party like a Romney and on and on, McCain and so on. So I think we're looking at a political transition to, first of all, the collapse of the two-party system. You know, we talked about it a lot a few months ago about the collapsing Republican Party. It seems that in the short run they have reconvened in an alliance with Trump for the 2018 and maybe the 2020 elections. But if the Democrats don't take back the House, at least the House, I think the processes, I should say, of disintegration of the Democratic Party will then occur. But the significant thing in all of this is the legitimation crisis, where the masses of people will not and cannot accept the governance and rules of governance and the rules of rule of the elite. This is a moment where the masses attack the elites and go in the opposite direction of the elites on all questions. This is the significance of this moment. And of course, this moment begins with the 2016 election and the defeat of Hillary Clinton.
I mean, the situation you describe is half of the pre-revolutionary condition when the elites cannot rule in the manner in which they're accustomed. Well, you know, half that formula is when the people won't allow them to, and they don't accept that rule.
That's right.
And that seems certainly to be pretty close to where we are at this point. All right, we've got go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's right.
No, you go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, we've got about 4 minutes left. And so the last thing I guess I wanted to touch on is depending on the outcomes. I mean, we've got the possibility of either more or less status quo in Congress or some major shift towards the Democrats. Status quo or a shift towards the Republicans would also be status quo in terms of protecting Trump from impeachment and also perhaps in giving him room to pursue his agenda if you have status quo. If there's a radical shift the other way, of course, then he's under stress. So what do you see happening in November, one way or the other? What things will happen regardless of the outcome of the election?
Well, I don't think the Democrats are going to take back the House. And that is very important. That is huge politically. And if they can't take back the House in 2018, their chances of winning the presidency in 2020 almost get to the level of zero. I mean, it's almost their situation is worse than Trump's was in 2016.
Let me point something out in there too, by the way. If the Democrats take the House back, they get to choose the Speaker. If something happens, plane crash, Congress, votes, whatever, and they remove Trump and Pence, Speaker of the House is the next president until 2020. Right. So this is a very, very significant thing, regardless of what else happens.
Well, and what you're describing is something that comes close to a constitutional crisis, a huge, major constitutional crisis. Again, we always refer back to the Civil War and the constitutional crisis that the secession of the South represented. This is a different type of constitutional crisis, but nonetheless a constitutional crisis. And the removal of Trump would only put the vice president there, which would mean they would have to impeach him as well for a Democrat to become the president. Does that mean that, we don't know what it means, and it's all speculative. But I think what we're looking at, and I think the Democrats are beginning to come to grips with this, that the way things are trending, it does not look like they can take the House back. And if they don't take the House back, as a party, I think they're pretty much done. And the other thing is, that means they will go into an internal struggle. And it's not just the so-called left or Bernie forces versus the so-called right or Hillary forces. There are many factions within the Democratic Party. The labor faction, not to mention the black vote within the Democratic Party, which I contend is very independent. They usually vote by not voting. And they know the country, broad sections, especially of the white population, are in rebellion against the elites.
Tony, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.